be subscribed to in Multnomah County, is we will provide the lady with a tape recorder and a suction cup that goes on a telephone so that she can obtain the conversation between her and her husband, or the threats that are being made towards her, which satisfy the requirements for the telephone harassment. Without the ability or her ability to do that, I don't think we'd have a case. And I think there are some women out there that have some very legitimate concerns regarding being harassed by the telephone, and I'm not talking about in person right now. That's a different area. Oftentimes, a woman will change her phone number, but the husband gets the new phone number from the kids, and it starts all over again. And I think it's
isn't just harassment. It may be a prelude to some real violence.
Exactly. I mean, there's probably no worse call that a policeman can go on than a family disturbance call. It does enable us to get involved, and it does enable us to bring it to the court and allow the court to hear exactly what's going on. This would preclude us from doing that anymore.
I'm sure that the committee would want to give that kind of protection. There's an incredible news account in the Village Voice newspaper a couple of years ago, I think called Sunday Pass, where this ex-husband kept threatening his wife, and finally they locked him up. They let him out on a Sunday pass, and he went and killed his wife. And it goes through the whole thing and all the warnings and the attempts to deal with that.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the bother of coming. We'll close the hearing now on Senate Bill 485 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 741. First on the list is Senator Cliff Troll, but it indicates Tricia Frohlander. Is the attorney Mark Donahue?
Yeah.
Okay, Mark Donahue, the requester of the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, I've submitted a written form of my testimony, and I trust you all have, and I will not, because of the hour, go through that. Simply summarize.
There's a letter here from Jeb Bladeen, March 31, opposing the bill. It's my understanding that you've come to some compromise with some...
I've discussed the matter with him. Excuse me.
Excuse me.
Yes, I've discussed the matter with Mr. Bladeen, who... as I understand it, is the legislative chairperson of
Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association,
and the editor of the McMinnville News Register. I'm joined by Senator Troll now. Perhaps I can defer to him for his initial comments.
Greetings, Senator Troll.
Thank you, Senator Wires and members. Senator Troll from Senate District 18. I just come from an education committee which I've chaired, and my thoughts are not all that well directed, but I want you to know that I'm supporting Senate Bill 741 at Mr. Donahue's suggestion. I had the bill drafted, and I hope that you'll give it due consideration. I think it's an important bill. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Donahue.
Thank you, Senator Troll. I have submitted as Exhibit B in my statement some proposed amendments, and they aren't in the form of line-by-line amendments, because in a sense, instead of 741, which now puts the bill in another specific statute, my Exhibit B keeps them in ORS 137.225, which is the present expungement statute. And so I would ask the committee to consider that. Basically, the bills accomplish the same thing. And I use the word expungement advisedly, because this bill does not ask for the destruction of the arrest record, but merely the sealing of the arrest record, with the same limitations as are presently existing for the sealing of a conviction record, including fingerprinting, including a 10-year conviction-free record, including 3 years from the date of the arrest prior to applying for the sealing of the record, and including the fact that there are no presently pending criminal charges against the applicant. I would also point out to the committee that this is a discretionary matter with the court, and although it's my experience that most judges will in fact grant the expungement, nonetheless, there is a case, as cited in my testimony, from the Court of Appeals, which the court, because of a person's conduct after his conviction, specifically on his probation, was denied expungement, so that it is discretionary. Nonetheless, what the bill addresses is a problem which has come up, which is basically the unfair treatment between people who are convicted, who can seal their records, and people who are arrested, but for some reason are not convicted for a variety of reasons, as discussed in my written testimony, who cannot seal the record. Hopefully, when all of you are arrested for recording this conversation without advising me, we can expunge your arrest record without the necessity of having you convicted.
We'll have to make that one, repeal that one.
I have talked to two different agencies which have had, I guess, historically some opposition to this type of bill. One was to Jeb Ladin, and the other was to Eula Stapleton, who represented the District Attorneys Association. I think it's fair to say that both these people were concerned more with the destruction of the arrest record rather than simply the sealing of it. And in fact, there are, under the 741, as the amendments are proposed, two ways in which you can unseal them. One is in a civil action where truth is a defense, and that's always been there. Subparagraph 9 on page 4 of my Exhibit B also would allow either a prosecutor or a defendant, if they need to do so, to investigate their own pending case, to unseal, so to speak, the arrest record if they need any information out of that. The committee should be aware that that would only come 3 years after the arrest itself, and we would all hope that the press or anyone who needed any information would have gotten it in that three-year period of time. So it doesn't seem unreasonable to seal it after 3 years. Mr. Bladin also posited a situation where there would be an investigation of a police officer who was treating his friends favorably and either not arresting or arresting his friends for other less serious crimes, and whether the press could look into that 3 years later. My response to that was that that's probably going to happen fairly infrequently. If you don't get wind of it in 3 years, it's probably not going to crop up after that time. But if so, and if it's important enough for a prosecutor to file some sort of an accusatory instrument, then in fact, either side could get into those sealed records.
Well, what would happen if somebody was arrested and there was no accusatory instrument filed, and 3 years later their arrest record was sealed, and 2 years after that they ran for a state office and the press wanted to go and refresh their memory about that, look into it? How would they get at it?
Under the bill as written, I don't think the press can do that if they don't already know about it in that three-year period of time. If they do know about it, case law is clear that they can comment on that, and they can run articles, and they can say the person's been convicted, even though he could deny it. But I would just say that I don't think that's going to be a problem 3 years down the road if somebody hasn't picked it up already. It seems to me that the benefits coming from this bill are a lot more important than maybe a case-by-case detriment that you can think of. The reason I'm here in the first place is because of basically students who I represent that go to OSU who for some reason or another run somewhat afoul of the law, not serious enough to be prosecuted, serious enough perhaps to be arrested and put on some sort of diversionary program. And yet those students, when it comes time to apply for a job at a bank, for instance, where there are certain bonding requirements, are at a disadvantage over someone who's actually been convicted of something even as serious as criminally negligent homicide, who could expunge that in 3 years. I think the district attorney's concerns, again, had to do with the destruction of the records, and that just doesn't happen. Although they had some, Mr. Stapleton had some concerns about whether he wanted, I'll try to say what his concerns were, which is whether they should, you should be able to seal an arrest record for something more serious than a misdemeanor. The problem it seems there is that if we put a ceiling on what you cannot seal as far as being arrested but never convicted, we may be encouraging police officers to arrest for a more serious charge than necessarily happen in order to simply have a record on the person.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Trow.
Questions by the committee? This is a bill that I supported in the past, but the a professor of the journalism department at the University of Oregon came in and opposed it. That was expungement. You're saying this is sealing. So I was concerned when I saw this bill it would run into the same problem.
I've specifically not used the word expungement because nobody really knows what that means. But I have used the word sealing the records. The same exact procedure would be used as is now used for convictions. And I'm just not sure of any problems that the public has had with it, with sealing convictions.
And you said you talked with Jeb Bledin about this of the Oregon newspaper?
Yes, he said that his concerns were expressed in the letter. I believe the bill addresses those concerns because there is no destruction and because of the long time period prior to the sealing. And he told me that his absence would speak for his concern against the bill. In other words, not being here, he's not too concerned about this bill.
And have you talked, counsel, have you talked with Mr. Bledin about this hearing, or was he mailed a notice of the hearing? Routinely, people that are that correspond with us on a bill are notified.
I did not talk with him personally. I know that Mr. Donahue has talked with him last week, and I'm sure he was aware of the hearing on the bill.
I'm talking about the hearing today, and he said he was aware it was today.
Yes, I did, and he specifically said he wouldn't be here because he felt that our discussion had eased his mind somewhat.
Okay. Are there questions or comments by members of the committee? Do you want to consider having a work session on these amendments today? Or?
I would, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator, we'll close the public hearing. I believe you're the only one, Senator. Wait, excuse me. No. Someone's here from the ACLU and also Clifford Cargas. I apologize. Thank you very much. Clifford Cargas. We have a newspaper article and a letter from you in our file, Mr. Cargas, is that right?
I hope you have a file. Yes.
Yeah, you sent us a letter dated April 11th.
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Since you have that file, I just stated that I was arrested and I never went to court, never had a chance to prove my case in court that I was innocent. I would like to have my record expunged or sealed.
Okay.
I know how it feels to be arrested and not go to court over it.
Not be able to get your record sealed or expunged.
Sure, it's expunged.
Okay.
Hmm. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. Don Friedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Friedman, again, from the American Civil Liberties Union. I've given to your counsel, I believe she's distributing a copy of my testimony. My testimony in favor of Senate Bill 741 is essentially the same as the testimony submitted in the last legislative session in favor of House Bill 2435. I believe that Senate Bill 741 is functionally identical to House Bill 2435. My own involvement personally arose out of representing a fellow a few years ago in an effort to have the court create a
right of expungement. We filed a proceeding in Multnomah County Circuit Court to have the record of arrest expunged of a young fellow who had been arrested, and that was that. The charges were never prosecuted. Judge Kirkham in Multnomah County Circuit Court agreed and expunged, or sealed, this is really a more appropriate term, sealed the arrest record. The case went up on appeal to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled to the contrary, reversed the 2-1 decision by the Court of Appeals, saying there was no judicially recognizable right of, to have records expunged in Oregon. We asked for a review by the Supreme Court, and that was denied. So that's where matters have stood. Across the country, I had done some work in connection with my earlier testimony 2 years ago. Approximately 15 or 20 states have some sort of sealing or expungement procedure available for arrest records, and we would suggest that that Oregon do the same. It's just a little bit silly, and we thought a denial of equal protection to have an expungement right exist for someone who's been convicted, but not for someone who's been arrested. When someone has been convicted, incidentally, and does have his arrest records expunged under the existing statute, what gets expunged are not only the conviction records, but also the arrest records. So in a sense, someone really is better off having been convicted for a crime 3 or 4 years later than if he is simply arrested and things are dropped, or if he's acquitted. And that's just a little bit silly. I have proposed one amendment to the proposed bill. It's a series of amendments, but getting to the same thing. Basically, we suggested reducing the period that someone has to wait from 3 years down to 1 year. I've reviewed that the proposed bill, or the alternate bill that was submitted by Mark Donohue, and personally, I like that approach of incorporating it within the existing expungement statute. I haven't gone through his bill that closely, but the approach, I think, makes sense. It would pull it all together into one statute rather than spreading it out in two places. It would still preserve the objection that I have to requiring a 3-year wait after an arrest. I would suggest that it be reduced down to 1 year, but I think that the principle is more important than that, what I regard as a detail. Does anybody have any questions? I'll conclude otherwise.
Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing after that. It's going to a brief work session. How do you feel about the 1 year instead of 3 year idea?
I'm supportive.
For sealing, if we go to the sealing idea.
I think that's reasonable.
1 year?
Yes.
And how about instead of after acquittal, at any time after such acquittal, dismissal or acquittal?
Yep.
Okay, well,
I like, Mr.
Yes,
also, I think the idea of incorporating that into the existing expungement law is a pretty good one. I think that's probably the way to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you like the Mark Donohue approach of the request of the bill of making it sealed rather than expunged?
I think so. That may get us off, that may eliminate some of the opposition from the OMPA, too. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, he's been talking with them, and they said they'd be here. Their not being here would indicate their lack of opposition. But I think what we ought to do. Mm-hmm. Is ask council to prepare, get us a legislative council draft that incorporates Donohue's amendments and the ACLU amendments. That'll give us time to check with OMPA. I think we also ought to check with the University of Oregon Journalism Department, because they had very strong feelings about this last time I saw this bill, and the District Attorney's Association.
Yeah, Mr. Wasserman has a letter in here.
Mr. Stapleton is the person to whom Mr. Donohue was referring, and they did.
Right.
I will go ahead and.
Could I ask a question since I wasn't involved, I guess, in the last round?
Senator Henderson.
Do they also object to these groups? They also object generally to expungement records? Because mm-hmm. I don't know, because there doesn't seem to be, it seems crazy to allow the conviction records to be expunged,
yeah,
and not
all
the arrest records.
Oh. Okay, we'll bring this back for a work session. I don't think we've given council some direction on where we want to go. I don't think we need any motion this time. That leaves two bills to go. Senate Bill 397. I need a sign-up sheet, I guess, on that. Oh, Senator, Representative Hanlon, are you out of a committee?
No, I'm not.
Can You can wait a few minutes. The people here on this next bill have been here since 3 o'clock, and although we ordinarily extend legislative courtesy, we should... I don't want to be rude to people
either.
Stephen Walters. Sherry Osier.
Sherry Osier.
This is about the 16th letter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sherry Osier, representing the Women's Rights Coalition. The testimony that's being passed out now is really, to some extent, it details by section what we are proposing to repeal. As you know, the Women's Rights Coalition requested this bill be introduced. We believe very strongly that unconstitutional statutes should be taken off the book. In 1973, the Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions were handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. After that, the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon in Benson v. Johnson held a number of sections in the Oregon abortion law unconstitutional. And after that, the Attorney General, in a letter opinion to Representative Vera Katz and then Representative Stephen Kufore, detailed the impact of the Benson decision on Oregon law. In my testimony, as I said, I go down through each statute briefly and explain why those statutes are being repealed. Stephen Walters from the American Civil Liberties Union is here and will testify a little bit later. If you have any technical questions, I'm sure he can answer. If I can answer any questions, I'll be happy to.
Are there any questions? Last session, there was a bill that repealed some unconstitutional provisions, and it also had some other provisions in it. Does this bill have anything other than deleting the unconstitutional provisions in it?
No. It does amend some of the statutes. It removes this technical changes. It removes some of the sections that refer to statutes that are being repealed. So there are some technical changes in this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Gender
Council.
Cleanup. Well, that's true, and there's also gender cleanup, and I think only in one place.
Any other questions? Senator Brown.
The concern last time, of course, was, as the chairman stated, that the bill, many felt, was overreaching in the sense it dealt with provisions of the law that were not addressed by the courts. Mm-hmm. I have not studied this at this point, but I know I'll look at it very carefully with that in mind.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Rita Radich.
Good afternoon. I'm Rita Radich, Portland attorney and president of Right to Life Oregon. We have a number of concerns about this bill, not that we are really excited about the abortion statutes as they presently are in the books, but that there are some provisions that certainly should not be repealed. The Benson versus Johnson case that the previous witness referred to did indicate that certain provisions under that are being asked to be repealed are unconstitutional, at least in part, and felt that they could not distinguish or at least take out the constitutional portions from the unconstitutional portions, and therefore ruled the whole section unconstitutional. Those particular sections that were ruled unconstitutional were only four: ORS 435.415, 435.4, I believe it's 25, 35, 255. 355 and 335, only subsections 1 and 2. In other words, after the definition section, the first four sections that appear with 435 only having sections 1 and 2 declared unconstitutional. This leaves in a number of other provisions, as well as bringing up the question as to whether all the items in those provisions that were held unconstitutional in total because of some portion of them being unconstitutional should not be excerpted out and kept as law in Oregon. We are particularly concerned about several items. Number one is that this whole section requires that the physician perform the abortion. Without these sections at all present, there is some concern as to whether or not physicians only will be allowed to perform abortions in the state of Oregon.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Hendrickson.
Rita, wouldn't the act that regulates the practice of medicine handle that?
I don't believe so. I've looked at that because that question came up last year. Mm-hmm. And the act does, I think on the first page of my testimony, I set forth the provisions of the act that deal mm-hmm. with defining what the doctors, what the practice of medicine includes. Mm-hmm. And for instance, if an abortion were induced by a drug not for compensation, that it appears that someone other than a doctor could perform that abortion, if that would come under this section. It's not clear whether an abortion...
But if it was it would have to be a prescriptive drug. I mean, I guess, I don't know what you could do about something like that. If it wasn't a prescriptive drug, anybody could probably get their hands on it anyway, couldn't they? I mean...
Well, that's a question that probably needs to be addressed. You know, it's not something you really want to leave to by default. I think it's something that this committee should take a look at. The other item is that, you know, is an abortion a surgical procedure? It's been often said to be that, but in terms of any statutory definition, there is none, nor any case law specifically saying that an abortion is a surgical procedure. Some abortions may be because they do require some cutting of the, but in others, it's simply a premature induced delivery.
Sure. Senator Garden.
I want to follow too. I'm not following why do you take the position that if a drug is administered without compensation, that does not follow within 677.085 prim 4?
Well, I think there's a question there that if it were given without compensation, it may not come under that provision.
What is it? Where is the requirement that there be compensation?
Sub 2, for compensation directly or indirectly received or to be received, offer or undertake to prescribe, give or administer any drug.
But, does that mean that, surely that can't mean that physicians who are employed by or county health departments who are offering, let's say, free health services to indigent persons, can employ non-physicians to perform medical services apart from abortions. If that's the case, we ought to amend the Medical Practice Act in its entirety to cover that because that's not a problem.
It's not a problem. I didn't look at it with that problem in mind, but that could well be a problem if you look at it.
You take that position, though, that the statute allows
it appears to say
indigent
on its face,
healthcare to be performed by non-physicians.
It appears on its face that may be an exception to this statute, which defines what medical practice is.
Again, if that is a problem, I would suggest that should be addressed in a separate vehicle through the through a general change to the Medical Practice Act.
Well, my experience when I was county attorney dealing with the county, with this medical, is that they're jealous guard of their turf on any of these, and I don't know if you've looked at any of their administrative rules or anything, but I think they usually are pretty zealous about not allowing any, even other health practitioners, to do things that they might, you know, because I've seen that context too in indigent mm-hmm. Clinics, not dealing with abortion issues, but dealing with other issues where it is indigence, they're not getting paid by, but they're nurse practitioners or something like that performing an activity which the doctors felt were within their purview. And my experience, and I'm not expert at all, but it seems like the medical practitioners are very zealous about policing their medical prerogatives,
yeah.
And I haven't noticed them differentiating whether the people get a fee or not. So I don't know if they, it'd be interesting to see how they flesh out the statute through their administrative rules in terms of...
I was personally surprised that's the way it read.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Senator Garner, did you have another question?
No, I'm sorry. That's all.
Do you want to continue, Ms. Reyes?
I guess also under subsection 4, it's not certainly not clear that an abortion is an undertaking to diagnose, cure, or treat what might be considered disease, illness, pain, wound, fracture, infirmity, deformity, defect, or abnormal physical or mental condition. So it doesn't certainly fit under 4. And it may or may not fit under surgical operation.
Senator Garner?
Yeah, why would it not fit under surgery? If it were, wouldn't it fit either under drug or surgical operation?
Depends what you mean by surgical operation. There is no definition of surgical operation. People have their own feelings on what that might be.
Isn't that a term of art, though, that would have been interpreted through the administrative rulings of the administrative interpretation?
It perhaps may be.
Are you familiar with those?
No, I'm not. We're also looking, though, at the situations where something very close to surgical intervention is not necessary for the abortion. There are many different ways of performing abortions. That's certainly, the reason we've raised this is I don't think the legislature has ever taken a position that abortions should be or can be performed by non-physicians. That it's, even though it's, it may, according to some literature, not be a terribly risky procedure in the first trimester, for instance, we still have not given that option to the public at large. And I think that what we're looking at here is to be sure what our law says, not leave it to ambiguous interpretation or lack of anything to cover it at all. We also have a concern, 435.435 sub 3, which is not reversed by the court in Benson versus Johnson. It's on page 2 at the top of my...
And the recovery is under workers' comp.
Even though the injury isn't covered by workers' comp at all.
That
doesn't seem right. Why is that a claim for injury covered by any workers' compensation law? That's what I don't understand. Why is that incident covered?
I can respond to that, Senator Gardner. There's a 1960, I believe 65 case, Widmer versus, I've forgotten who. It is a case that stands, it's a civil case that stands for the proposition that it was a malpractice case against a doctor by an injured worker, and it stands for the proposition, no, I guess I may have that backwards. What it stands for is the proposition that the negligence of a doctor in the treatment of a workers' compensation injury is covered by the workers' compensation insurance that first covered that injury because it is a compensable consequence of that injury.
So you can't sue
it out. And therefore wipes it out. That's an earlier, I believe.
So this is just an extension of that doctrine, really, and applied against the public.
So really, it would become a fair game to have people commit malpractice.
That's correct within this particular statutory setup.
The director of the Callahan Center is here. Maybe, would you like to comment on this?
That's correct. Everything Richard said is correct. It's interpreted as an extension.
Could you give your name for the tape, please?
Gerald Ripka, administrator of the Callahan Center, representing the Department of Workers' Compensation. If I may?
Sure.
What Representative Hammond said is correct, and I was going to raise that issue. We share his concerns in that area, but from a different standpoint.
We look at it
as an extension of the claim, the department. As far as Callahan Center is concerned, notwithstanding what Representative Hammond said as far as malpractice and the other thing, it's a different issue. But we look at it as an extension of the claim. Basically, to separate workers' comp money from the fund, from the tort liability fund. If we go on the premise that we're going to mix the two, then we create double dipping, and that's where we're looking at it. That's what our objections to the bill are, almost exclusively.
Yeah, but the whole purpose of workers' compensation, the basic, when we get back to why we have that, it doesn't really have anything to do with exempting professional negligence from tort liability, does it? I mean, that's a little something extra grafted onto the law, I guess, by judicial rule.
That's correct.
That's no part of the rationale of the workers' compensation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, part of the rationale that we're using in the department, and it's never been a question in the past, not to say it's right or wrong, is that this is an extension of the claim. And to separate and keep workers' comp money and the claim separated from any other liability, any third-party liability, they have said, and the legislature has said, that it will be an extension of the claim. Any treatment, any injury that arises out of treatment will be treated as the claim. There will be additional time loss. There will be additional added monies in the determination order. It's the worker is compensated, whether it's correct or not, I wouldn't be here to say, but the worker does get compensation.
If he gets his wrong arm cut off, is it $16,000 or is it $20,000?
Well, it will be a scheduled, right or wrong, it is a scheduled disability.
That's not an injury he incurred as in the work environment. It's fortuitous that it happened that way, but
it might not be too fortuitous.
Senator Hendrickson.
Well, Cindy, that is the policy issue that we need to decide, and I agree with you. I think the reason that they bar lawsuits in worker compensation was that there was a quid pro quo. The employers were going to be free of liability, and the injured worker is going to be assured of a source and a fund. But to me, this is a different type of a tort than the accident that happens on the job. And it seems as a policy matter, what we have done by allowing this is to then not adequately protect people from the torts that can occur either in malpractice or perhaps other contexts, because there's no real financial deterrent, a very great financial deterrent to the tortfeasors. And I think they probably should segregate their money and put it in a reserve for the...
Let me follow up on that. What happens in that instance? Does somebody goes presumably in the health sciences university incident, or a private doctor, somebody goes to chase that doctor's professional liability insurance, don't they?
Yes, but still, it's still considered an extension of the claim. And I'd like to address...
Can I just ask a question? Do your doctors carry malpractice insurance?
No. Mm-hmm. No, they do not. Because of exclusive rental. We're not subject to it. One thing I would like to address, and I don't want to deter from their testimony right now, is that it isn't an issue as quite as simple as a wrong arm. And I think you as a committee should consider that when you're talking, especially in comp claims, it would be very difficult to determine where the original injury, as far as Callahan's concerned, and I'm limiting my comments to Callahan, it would be very difficult in rehabilitation to determine where the original injury occurred and where it was either facilitated or aggravated or whatever. It would be a very difficult litigation.
Well, that probably cuts both ways. That's why I've never taken a medical malpractice case, although I've looked into a few of them. The lawyer has to ask themselves if they want to invest all that money for expert witnesses and all that time on a contingent fee basis, which is the way medical malpractice cases are done, if they aren't going to be able to show a very clear case, because along with everything else, juries aren't jumping through hoops to award damages against doctors either. Yeah.
Presumably, let me follow up on that. We would have to presumably, to be fair on the other side, we would have to say that this is not a compensable injury. I mean, it's not a compensable under the workers' compensation statutes, wouldn't we?
Senator Gardner, if I might respond to that, under the law of the workers' comp 656, under these kinds of cases, this would be a third-party case, and if there were recovery, mm-hmm. then the insurer that originally covered the case would be subject to reimbursement out of that worker's recovery. Mm-hmm. So in that case,
there'd be a lien,
mm-hmm. and that would cover, I think, the situation that you're addressing in your question.
They get paid back from the recovery of the worker.
And therefore, it could still be defined as a compensable injury because the insurer would get that money back if the worker were successful.
Insurer gets two-thirds up to the full amount of what they've paid out. And the worker gets a third as incentive to bring the claim, a third-party claim. Senator Hamby.
I was going to ask Mr. Ripka about
The other side of the coin, when you mentioned that none of the, your physicians, practitioners, are currently covered with any kind of liability coverage, workman's comp claims currently also go through Providence, do they not?
Yes, they do.
The Voc Rehab. And so would the situation be true there also?
Yes, it would.
Any malpractice?
Yes, it would. Mm-hmm. Providence, Sacred Heart.
Right.
And Manual and...
And so the injury... I guess
it's actually Emmanuel Providence. Mm-hmm, it's Providence, right. Emmanuel, and mm-hmm. Sacred Heart Hospital.
Your physicians are not carrying professional liability insurance?
No, because they're not subject to the tort.
I asked them, they said no. But I was going to say, at a private hospital, I think most hospitals require people who have privileges at their hospital to maintain malpractice.
Mm-hmm. But this exclusive remedy does carry forth through our contract facilities. They are not subject to tort claims based on workers' compensation cases.
Yeah, so I agree with you on that, but I'm sure that most of these physicians, the hospitals require them to carry malpractice.
Yes, for their private practice at the hospital.
Is there an exclusion in their are there typically physician exclusions in the physician's policy that cover this situation?
I have no knowledge of that. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I want to clarify and then turn it over to Mr. Malagon, if I might. There is a bill presently pending on it's coming up on the floor of the House tomorrow, House Bill 2677, and that basically deletes 30.265 sub 3A, the one that says you can't sue a public body if there's any comp coverage. That bill passed out of House Judiciary 8-1 will be on the floor tomorrow. The additional effect of this bill is where the Callahan Center is exempt under 656 still remains in the statute, just so it's mm-hmm. clear on what else is pending within this building. I think Mr. Malagon might have a few things to say too.
I think virtually everything was covered during the colloquy that went on, but I suppose the question is going on in the committee's mind is, does this happen? Does malpractice occur at the Callahan Center with the claimant unable to do anything about it? And yes, it does. With the permission of one of my clients from the Coos Bay area, former truck driver by the name of Merle Buckley, I brought the medical reports, which indicated that in December of 1981, Merle, who'd been involved in a truck wreck, underwent a total left knee replacement and a left medial meniscectomy by his treating physician and orthopedist in the Coos Bay area, Alan Whitney, and that within a very short period of that surgery, the machinery of the workers' compensation system was insisting that Merle go to the Callahan Center over the objections of his treating physician. And through some mechanism which is revealed by these documents that I will leave with the committee, like it or not, and over the objections of his treating physician, Merle ended up being hauled from Coos Bay to sent to Wilsonville, and that's one of
or
the important
or lose his time loss.
Or lose his time loss, and that's one of the important considerations in this bill, because it's mandatory. Claimant has to go up there, and I included among the little exhibits that I put in here the May 20th, 1982 call-in letter to the Callahan Center from the Callahan Center referral specialist, which ends with, underlined, Oregon law requires us to inform you of your rights and responsibilities as an injured worker. Then, quote, attendance at this examination is mandatory. You are responsible for notifying us prior to the date or time of the exam of any valid reason why you cannot attend as scheduled. Failure to attend this examination, obstruction of the same, or an invalid reason for not attending shall result in suspension of your compensation benefits.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendricks.
You might be interested to know, in Senate Bill 215, or was it 216, they wanted to add additional sanctions for people that refused to go to the Callahan's.
Correct. And you are just forced to go up there, and you have to go when your client comes in and says, do I have to go? I don't want to. I don't want to leave my family. My doctor doesn't want me to go. Go. You have to. So he went.
And on June 9th, 1982, he arrived, and an intake was done by Robert W. Toon, the medical examiner for the Callahan Center. And it's a rather straightforward medical intake. We have no particular quarrel with it. A psychological evaluation was done by Jack Norman, Ph.D., which included such findings as Mr. Buckley's psychological status can be summarized as follows. Level of emotional disturbance, mild. Level of personality disturbance, none. Level of characterological disturbance, none. Diagnostic impression, possible psychophysiologic reaction. However, this would be a very mild state, and no significant hypochondriacal tendencies are indicated. This individual is highly motivated and should receive maximum assistance while he's up here. Well, then I included the chart notes from the person who's working with him on occupational therapy, which reveal that this highly motivated, no psychological problems injured worker who has had a total knee replacement on his left, but according to him and his doctor, when he got up there, was doing very, very well. In fact, I'd like to take a little bit of your time, and I don't really want to do this, I know it's late, but quote from Dr. Toon's report, where he states on the initial evaluation, this man is still making a strong effort to improve his physical condition, and according to his reports, the condition of his leg is still improving. Let me see if I can find it. He says he's very happy with the results obtained from the surgery. And the next thing you're going to find when I give you these is that when he leaves the Callahan Center, the first entry from his treating physician in Coos Bay is, he was up for a state examination. During the examination, they had him hold a medicine ball between his feet and do quad exercises. At that time, he had a sudden onset of severe pain in his knee on the lateral and anterior side, with pain going up and down into the tibia and the femur. The knee swelled up quite severely after that. He states it swelled up to his pants leg, and since then he's been having nothing but pain in his knee. He laid down all weekend with the leg up. On examination now, the swelling is down, etc., etc. He goes on with an examination and says, I think that they meaning the Callahan Center, have severely irritated the knee with what they were doing in the, and this is kind of amusing to me, in the rehabilitation camp. We will check him up in about 3 weeks. The end result of all of that, and this is also included in these documents, is another total knee replacement, plus Merle Buckley, who was forced to go up there over the objections of his doctor, his own objections, ended up with another surgery on his left knee, plus surgery on his right leg. And his physician, who is very concerned about this worker, as you might imagine, and my office have told Merle Buckley and his physician that there is nothing on God's green earth we can do about it because of this immunity that has been afforded those physicians at the Callahan Center who don't have to carry malpractice insurance. The final indignity to which Mr. Buckley was subjected is that the State Accident Insurance Fund then denied that he'd been hurt at the Callahan Center, and he ended up without any benefits for a while we fought the State Accident Insurance Fund. I have included, among the, as to how that happened, about a 4 or 5 page report from the consulting physician for the State Accident Insurance Fund, Dr. Norton, who simply indicated, without ever having talked to the claimant, but from the records, that these kind of things don't happen at the Callahan Center. And then the report, 4 pages long, from Frank B. Smith, M.D., Chief of Professional Services at the Callahan Center, that he checked very carefully, and these things don't happen at the Callahan Center. And
I just remember the provision that the chair was referring to. It was one that was going to remove from the matters that injured worker could have reviewed at a hearing questions of rehabilitation. Those were all going to be put into the administrative review of the director, and they couldn't be brought up at a hearing in front of a referee anymore. That may not be the one you were thinking of.
That's another one. There was one that was a direct sanction.
Oh, it was a sanction.
But I do think we should...
Okay, we've got to be back at another committee in a half an hour,
I have just one question,
Senator Gardner.
What is the rationale for simply extending this bill to the Workers' Compensation Department or its employees or agents? Doesn't the logic of it
I think it should be
beyond that?
Because of the other bill that Senator...
That's only public bodies.
Well, that's a good question. And
the logic of this would seem to suggest that that in the instance of professional negligence used in treating any worker, that ought not to be really covered by the system. That ought to be a separate tort.
You mean modest, and your logic is flawless.
So a person could go, an injured worker could go back against Kaiser as well? Well, no, they're not a public body.
Well, what's the logic for, what's the rationale for restricting it to public bodies? On the other hand, I am concerned with the double dipping question, and I think that would have to be.
Not quite sure whether I'm certain of what this double dipping is. If the claimant is injured in the course and scope of his employment and is receiving compensation for that, in the sense of double dipping that I think is being mentioned, every third party case is double dipping, except that the workers' compensation carrier does share in that recovery to the greatest extent, by the way.
Up to the extent of what they've paid out.
But I don't see the rationale for immunizing from tort liability people who commit malpractice, negligence in treating a worker who happens to be covered by workers' compensation.
Neither do we, and that's why we propose this bill.
It's not like when you're trading the tort liability of an employer for the certainty of compensation. That's a different kind of situation.
One of the thoughts that we had in drafting this particular bill is that we felt that that employers would get behind this bill, and that so would the workers' compensation carriers, because they get to share in that, and right now they have no control over what goes on at the Callahan Center.
But what's the situation with legal malpractice?
It's the same.
That ought to be...
Yeah, you can sue for legal malpractice if you're an injured worker, and many do. And the employer shares in that.
That's not preempted by the...
No.
But your idea of limiting just the Workers' Compensation Department was to make it narrow enough that there wouldn't be Kaiser and all those other people in here posing.
Correct.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Except they probably all carry malpractice insurance because they'd have to for their other patients.
The premiums are probably lower, though, because they're not... Right.
One of my best friends, being a Kaiser physician, I know that even though they carry malpractice, they are extremely... On that 60 Minutes show the other night about the man that died... After they unplugged him, first he wouldn't die when they took the respirator off, so then they took the IVs off. That was a Kaiser case down in California.
I didn't see it.
That's murder, though.
They charged him with murder.
Yeah.
That's what it was. Charged him with murder. The doctor.
Like that bridge they had.
But they're also going to sue them.
Yeah.
For a tremendous amount of money.
Chairman?
Yes.
And after claimant's attorney made his remarks, I almost sound mercenary, but since I do represent the department, I do have a couple...
Are you referring to Senator Gardner?
No.
Him. Beyond that. I thought you were looking at him. No, I'm a claimant.
Now, if you...
The way this works.
Okay. I do want to make a point, and I make it as the representative of the department, that we should point out to you that the fund... The current fund for tort liability is underfunded by $5.5 million. This will cost money, and I think I should make that point.
Well, it won't cost money if you don't malpractice.
Well,
Mr. Milligan,
a scenario there that I really wouldn't want to get into answering, but there is another side of the story, and we have
our
position.
There are two sides to every story.
Sure, certainly, and that's why we're not going to debate it. But the point is, I would like to make that we would be subject to this, and we would have problems with it from just an irritation, an aggravation would be litigated. and you'd have a terrible time determining the where the aggravation, if there was an aggravation to begin with, and where the court, the comp claim ended and the tort began. So I do want to make this, this is an important point, and I do want to make you aware, the sites you're looking for, I was going to raise the issue on the two-thirds recovery, is ORS 656, 576 to ORS 656, 595. And this is where the insurers would recover up to two-thirds, you're exactly right, Mr. Chairman, any benefit from this, and up to their costs.
Well, up to 100% of their costs.
Why would that be to the benefit of SAFE then, for instance, or the private carrier?
They would recover if, let's say...
The workers' comp carrier would actually come out ahead with this
yes,
kind of provision,
would.
Wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
And it would be basically, so it would be the professional liability policy picking up the slack a little bit on the workers' comp
department. This would be the department.
And the payment of the premium.
Right,
would be self-insured.
Well, there'd be no free lunch. The cost, the offsetting cost, as described by these two gentlemen, would be picked up by the fund. The assessment, which has been an issue in this session, and 16.8 assessment would go up significantly to pay for the offsetting cost in our insurance premiums to pay the fund. So there's no free lunch.
No, but you would. The fund would be. Wouldn't it be recouping money from the any recoveries that might be made against professional liability policies?
I couldn't speak to that. Gene Snyder is here. He could speak to that. He's from the General Services
Department. Well, I don't want to get. We're going to get.
We're going to have to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 557 right now. And are there any comments before we adjourn 557? And then other things. You have something other subject. Okay. Does anybody have any comments on 557 at this time? They have. Do we? Are you interested in the bill, or reschedule?
Yeah, I'll reschedule it for your work session.
Okay, well,
I want to hear more about some of that.
I would move to amend it to include, we can do that later. We've all got it marked here to add 556.018. Now, Senator Hamby.
I don't know if anyone else in the committee has received any contact or had any contacts at all following a Capitol Club briefing. Some sort on our ethics bills.
No.
And I was just wondering. I have, and I was just wondering if
run other bills now, so you guys
committee might be. Yes, these are some
ethics bills. You don't have to worry about ethics.
If the committee might be open to perhaps just having at least a brief session with the final document, probably prior to printing.
You've heard some things about that you're concerned about, or
right. Most especially the technical contacts, engineering staff in private industry making contact with engineering faculty at OSU regarding curriculum, et cetera.
We've gone over with all that stuff. Rulemaking and rate making that they have to report contacts.
There is quite a bit of concern again regarding rate making, most especially now with the the PUC and the projected incremental costs with whoops and PPNLs.
All we have to do is, if they're over there lobbying, is to report, and they are absolutely dead set against.
No. It's just other mid-management, in a larger. I'm talking about the larger firms. Yeah.
If they're lobbying, they file as lobbyists. If they're not, they don't have to.
What was the briefing?
That's it. I was just wondering if we wanted to, because there was a statement made by the lobbyist, a printed statement made by the lobbyist, that there is absolutely no gift is allowed. Well, I do recall
it's not
$10 worth of gifts.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm hopeful of quelling any kind of misinformation prior to the bill going to the floor of the Senate. And I thought even if we were to
Well, I think we should make efforts to find what, any ways we can communicate with these people about what's actually in the bill. Laura Goinian laid it out some today. Did you see that we got an editorial endorsement of the bill?
Yes.
Said it was a modest
lead editorial.
Yeah, it's the lead editorial today. It said it was a modest effort to improve the ethics law. I think we ought to try like crazy to communicate, but if we, I would be concerned about trying to reopen it. And now we've worked on it so long, and
I know.
We've put in a whole series of compromises and amendments.
I have to bring my bow down. But the definition of lobbying, per se, or lobbyist, when you're attempting, for instance, to impact curriculum, naturally, and there are physical implications that go along with it.
Rulemaking and rate making.
Curriculum
wouldn't be covered.
I'd be happy to go over it with you if you have questions like, would that help at all?
No, I thought for sure it was not. However, this was not the information they received.
Help us quell that, because I'm sure that that is not rate making, and certainly it's not rulemaking. Those are not APA proceedings when you're.
You see, very early on, not all attempts to attack these bills will be in good faith. Very early on,
yes.
Some people in the Capital Club lobby went to the labor lobby and told them that like AFL-CIO, every time they took anyone out to eat, they'd have to figure out which one of their local affiliates is paying for that.
Yeah.
And there's a long history of these kinds of things. You know, 77, when they did away with the interest rate limit on selling homes, they had one of the AFL-CIO lobbyists convinced that only had to do with retail purchases. And I managed to get those two people together and determine that the Capital Club lobbyist had told the labor lobby it's the wrong story, and it convinced him. I think we ought to figure out a way to rumor control.
Well, I think on this specific one, for instance, it's very important for some of the electronic manufacturers to have contacts with computer science and departments and engineering departments about how the curriculum ought to be structured. But those are not rulemaking proceedings. That's a very—it's a narrow term. It's a term of art, you know, and it has a defined beginning and a defined end. And it's—I think Dave Frohmeyer can help probably assuage some of those concerns because it was—remember—it was his suggestion we narrow it down to rulemaking.
Well, does the Crapper Club have frequent meetings? Maybe we could ask to have an opportunity to come and make a presentation.
I don't think they have.
Briefing.
I think it may have just been.
I think it would be important, though, that for that particular one, for Dave Frohmeyer, perhaps, to sit down with, say, Gary Conkling and Pat McCormick and see people like that to just point out that I'm confident, doesn't apply to that. Aren't you?
Oh, it does not apply to that.